Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Medieval History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Evan Zarkadis, your host, and in today's episode, I will be talking to Dr. Chrysovalantis Kyriakou, lecturer in ecclesiastical history at the Theological School at the Church of Cyprus in Cyprus, to talk about his book, Orthodox Cyprus Under the Latins, 1191 to 1571, Society, Spirituality, and Identities, published in 2018 by Lexington Books. Dr. Kyriakou specializes in late antique Byzantine, medieval and early modern history, and he focuses on the role of Cyprus as a place of ethno-religious encounter, interaction, and contention. With that, hello Chrysovalantis, and welcome to the show.
Hello Evan, thank you for having me.
Absolutely, such a pleasure, and it took us a little bit to get this podcast going, but here we are here.
yes.
So, perfect. So, let us begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a Byzantinist. I focus on the history of the Eastern Mediterranean, especially Cyprus, between late antiquity and the early modern period. And I am particularly interested in multi-religious societies and how these societies become the loci of contention, but also peaceful coexistence. And chronologically, I am particularly interested in the late medieval period. So I studied, I have a degree in history and archaeology from the University of Cyprus, and I later pursued my MA studies at Royal Holloway University of London, I did my this book's actually based on my doctoral dissertation at Royal Holloway, which was conducted under the supervision of Dr. Haralambos Dendrinos. Later on, I returned to Cyprus. I taught Byzantine history and archaeology at the University of Cyprus, at European University Cyprus. I recently completed a postdoctoral project at the Bank of Cyprus Cultural Foundation, and I am currently, I occupy the post of lecturer in ecclesiastical history at the Theological School of the Church of Cyprus.
Wow, that's quite the journey, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I had to do different things and pass from the different fields, but they all have something to do with Byzantium and the post-Byzantine world in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Quite the topic, of course, and we'll talk more about that while the interview progresses, but I want to ask a question. How was the experience turning your dissertation into a book?
Well, it was a long and a laborious project. I mean, I had to rewrite my thesis three or four times before submitting it as a concise and concrete piece of scholarship to be published. And of course, I had the expert guidance of Lexington Books, and especially my friend and editor, Professor Vlada Stankovic, who is also Byzantinist at the University of Belgrade. And he he's the editor of this wonderful series of books on Byzantium as a European empire.
Yes, I'm a little familiar with Dr. Stankovic's works. That's great. All right. So before we start, so the book is about identity in medieval Cyprus, right? So What is the state of the field currently, and which field is it? Is it considered under? Is it Byzantine studies, or is it a thing on its own? How will you identify the field of Cyprus identity, I guess, in that medieval period?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because people in academia so often ask me, are you a Byzantinist? Are you a medievalist? Are you a scholar of Cypriot studies? Well, the answer is, I am a Byzantinist. I am an ecclesiastical historian, but Byzantium, the Byzantine Eastern Mediterranean after the 13th century, as you very well know, becomes also the home of Western European populations. You have the Crusaders, you have the Venetians, you also have the expansion of the Muslim states, the Ottomans after the 14th and 15th century. So everyone is in this story. You can find everyone. And my book covers the period between the late 12th century and the late 16th century. So it's the end of the Middle Byzantine period, the beginning of the late Byzantine period after the fall of Constantinople in 1204. And this continues well after the final conquest of Constantinople by the Ottomans, with, of course, the formation and expansion of the Ottoman state and the war with the Venetians in the Eastern Mediterranean. So it touches upon different issues and different fields, but my training and my viewpoint is that of a Byzantinist and an ecclesiastical historian. So the aim of the book was to explore the identities of Orthodox Cypriots. I call them, rather anachronistically in the book, Greek Cypriots, but they describe themselves as Romei, as Romans, which was the same ethnic name also employed by the Byzantines. So there is this this element of ethnic and religious and political connection to the Byzantine Empire. So the main question and the reason why I wrote this book was to what extent did they preserve and did they adapt their Romaic identity, their Byzantine identity, as a result of the Latin conquest? Did they see themselves as something else, as a new category of ethnic and religious category? so the state of research, we have three main lines of interpretation. We have the colonial, British colonial line of interpretation, which was developed in the 1940s and 50s, because Cypriot historiography, and this is something that we can discuss a bit more later on, is highly politicized as a result of the modern history of Cyprus. So the British tried to present a view of Cypriot identity that was, in a way, denationalized. It was neither Greek nor Turkish. It was Cypriot in the very strict geographical sense, and in that way they hoped that they would make the Cypriots, especially the Greek Cypriots, as loyal colonial subjects against the rising tide of the Greek Cypriot unionist movement, which was demanding enosis, union with Greece. You have the anti-colonial struggle, the Greek Cypriot anti-colonial struggle in the 1950s, and in 1960, Cyprus becomes a bicommunal Greek and Turkish Cypriot independent state. So in the 1960s, there is between the 1960s and 1990s, there is the creation, the emergence of a Greek Cypriot ethnocentric or nationalist slash nationalist historiography, which attempts to deconstruct the earlier British colonial line of interpretation. So you have this bleak picture of, or heroic picture of Orthodox Greeks fighting against the tyranny of the Latins, the Turks, and so forth. The problem with this approach is that is not confirmed, is simply not confirmed by the evidence, by the majority of Latin sources of this period. And this is the reason why after the 1990s, there has been a growing revisionist tendency in Cypriot historiography, which is primarily based on this Latin material, especially papal letters and Latin ecclesiastical documents, which are more interested in the management and administration of the Latin church in Cyprus and how the Orthodox were incorporated into this concept of the universal Roman church. When I was, as an undergraduate, I was interested in the church history of the Latin period, and I was unsatisfied with all these lines of interpretation. I mean, there is this model of completely integrated societies and this model of completely segregated societies, but none of these models was seemed to me that none of these models was reflected in what the sources had to say. So I chose this subject as the subject of my doctoral dissertation, and I came across new sources which presented a very different picture of the period. And this led to the writing of this book. This book, in a way, represents a third path, a third kind of interpretation, which is a post-revisionist line of interpretation, in the sense that I understand that the revisionist scholars are right in revising the nationalist ethnocentric model, but I also criticize the fact that they return to the arguments of colonial British colonial historiography in order to prove that the ecclesiastical condition in Cyprus was harmonious all the time, with no tension, a rose-tinted paradise of convivencia that simply does not take into account the Byzantine Orthodox perspective. But this, on the other hand, does not mean that I agree with nationalist scholars that there was a continuous, ongoing struggle, everyday struggle against the Latins. So the truth is somewhere in the middle.
That's where your book comes in.
Yes, I mean, in my view, it was both Cypriot society between the 13th and 16th century was both an integrated and a segregated society.
It's quite an interesting way to think and view this concept, for sure. But yeah, it's so fascinating how what you just mentioned, how politics, like modern politics, can really affect maybe how we get to analyze and view history. And maybe Cyprus is one of the best examples of that in today's scholarship. Wow, yeah, it's so much to uncover there, but you just packed it in together in a few minutes so well. So the book, so as you mentioned, is late 12th, I believe, and then all the way up to the 16th.
Yes, yes. 1191 is when Richard the Lionheart comes to Cyprus.
So talk to me a little bit about the historical context quickly from the 12th to the 16th period. Where was Cyprus at that point?
Well, Cyprus was part of the Byzantine Empire from the very beginning. I mean, it was part of the Roman Empire from 1st century BC. So in the late 12th century, Cyprus is conquered by Richard I of England, Richard the Lionheart, who was traveling to the Holy Land as part of the Third Crusade. Richard sold Cyprus to the Templars, and the Templars later returned Cyprus to Richard, and Richard sold Cyprus again to Guy de Lusignan, who was the Crusader King of Jerusalem. Jerusalem had just been conquered by Saladin. So the Lusignan dynasty, which was a Frankish dynasty, they were French from Poitou, they were established in Cyprus as the exiled kings of Jerusalem. And they founded the Lusignan kingdom in 1192, which was both the kingdom of Cyprus and the kingdom of Jerusalem. And the Lusignans ruled Cyprus roughly as late as 1474 to 1489, when Venice comes in and Cyprus becomes part of the Venetian Stato d'Amare, the Venetian Maritime Empire. So the Venetians ruled Cyprus until 1570, 1571, when we have the Ottoman invasion and the Great War of Cyprus, which ends with the Ottomans conquering Cyprus in 1571. This is the general political context. So when the Latins come in the late 12th century, they don't have... historically, they don't have an ecclesiastical presence on the island. So they have to create, they have to found their own church. And we have the founding of the Latin Church in Cyprus in 1196. And gradually, the Latin Church in Cyprus gains power and is supported, of course, by the Lusignan kings and the popes. And this gradually leads to the subjugation of the Greek, the Orthodox Byzantine Church of Cyprus. So at this point, I should mention that the Orthodox Church in Cyprus was recognized as an independent church, as an autocephalous church, very early in its history. It was founded sometime before the middle of the first century AD, and in the fifth century it was recognized by the third ecumenical council in Ephesus as an autocephalous church, which was it means that it was a very highly esteemed church within the Byzantine world. So what the Latins do is that they abolish 4 out of 14 bishoprics, and they make the remaining for Orthodox bishops to be under the their Latin counterparts. And we have occasions when the Latins seize the property of Orthodox monasteries, but these are rather rare cases. In 1231, there is this unique case in the whole Latin-ruled Eastern Mediterranean of the unique case of a whole monastic community of Orthodox being executed by the Latins. This is the it's well known as the martyrdom of the 13 monks of Kandara in 1231. It became an international scandal in ecclesiastical politics of this period. You have papal emissaries traveling to Nicaea to visit the Byzantine emperor in exile to discuss how they should resolve the crisis between the ecumenical patriarchate and the papacy, which was created by the execution of these monks in Cyprus. And the reason for executing the monks was, it tells us something about how the Orthodox of Cyprus saw themselves and the Latins. I mean, the visual barrier between Orthodox and Latins in this period was the Eucharist, and the way the Eucharist was prepared. I mean, the common people could not understand high theology and doctrinal issues, but they could understand the nature of the bread, of the Eucharistic bread offered to them. So the Latin Church uses unleavened bread, the Orthodox Church uses leavened bread, but the Latins could tolerate the use of leavened bread as long as the Orthodox accepted the validity of the Latin sacrament. But the problem was that in the Byzantine tradition, Orthodoxy is closely related to orthopraxy, to correct ritual practice. So if the ritual is not performed in a correct way in the Orthodox view, it's not doctrinally correct. So when the monks were asked whether the Latin position is correct, they answered what was the traditional Orthodox position, that this is heretical. But on their own part, the Latins could not tolerate what they saw as insult. So the monks were incarcerated, tortured, and finally burned at the stake, which was a horrible way of dealing with this matter. It created tension, and this tension continued as late as the end of the 13th century. Around the middle of the 13th century, we have an attempt to reach a compromise. We have the Bulla Cypria, which was a papal bull, in a way sanctioning the reduction of Orthodox bishoprics, but leaving the Orthodox to preserve their rite and liturgical traditions under the papal church. So from this moment onwards, the Orthodox are placed under a papal institutional framework, but they have the right to preserve their doctrines and practices. The 14th century is in the 14th century we see gradual revival in the Orthodox Church of Cyprus. I mean the Lusignan kings are more keen to offer their protection and patronage to the local church, And we also see the Orthodox of Cyprus being participating in this major theological controversy of the late Byzantine world, which was the controversy over the theology of Hesychasm. Hesychasm controversy began in the 1330s and continued as late as the 1390s. It was a controversy over the monastic belief, the Athonite monastic belief, and that purified humans can enjoy psychosomatic experiences of union with God. So the monk is transformed by this uncreated divine light that surrounds Christ and becomes Christ-like himself. So you have Cypriot theologians, Orthodox Cypriot theologians, coming from a place that is outside the empire, but who are willing to participate in this controversy and discuss this issue, supporting either the one or the other side. And this tells us something about how they saw themselves. They saw themselves as Byzantines outside the Byzantine Empire. And they are accepted as such by the Imperial Church, the Ecumenical Patriarchate, in Constantinople. So this is what happens in roughly what happens in the 14th century. In the 15th century, the 15th century is a period of major crisis for the Lusignan Kingdom. You have the Genoese conquering the port city of Famagusta, which was the wealthiest city on the island. You have the Mamluks invading Cyprus and capturing the Lusignan king at the Battle of Hierokitia, and then plundering the capital, plundering Nicosia. So everything gradually collapses. But the Lusignans are able to restore their power, reconquer Famagusta, and to do so, they cultivate a greater degree of interdependence with the local communities, the local non-Latin communities. Because apart from the Orthodox, we have various groups of Syrians being established in Cyprus. We also have Maronites, Armenians, Copts, so all kind of Christian communities living in the Levant are established in Cyprus. And so the Lusignans are quite tolerant towards these groups, but at the same time, they demand in exchange loyalty, and they have this loyalty. This is a moment for the Orthodox Church in Cyprus to bolster this tendency of revival. They exploit the vacuum created by Latin episcopal absenteeism. You have Latin bishops that are they do not live in Cyprus, but they have the title and are established in France or in Italy. And this creates problems of pastoral guidance for the local Latin community. And this is where the Orthodox come in. They perform the sacraments, they offer the Eucharist, they bless marriages, and so forth. And they are recognized as the valid spiritual authority on the island, not only by the Orthodox, but also by the Latins. And this continues also in the 16th century when the Venetians come. Cyprus is, for the Venetians, the most distant, the most prosperous, and the most strategically important colony in their stat on the mar, in their maritime empire. For this reason, they are quite tolerant towards the Orthodox. They employ Orthodox administrative structures to control the Orthodox population. And what is very important is that in the 1560s, just a decade before the Ottoman invasion in Cyprus, when the new Latin Archbishop of Cyprus, Philip Homotsenigo, attempts to impose the principles of the Counter-Reformation, because we have the Reformation and then the Council of Trent in Italy, and the attempt of the papacy to fight back against Protestantism. So when the principles of the Counter-Reformation are being transferred to Cyprus, and there is a reaction on the part of the Orthodox clergy and population, the Venetians support the Orthodox, and they order the Latin Archbishop to leave the island. And this is because they recognize that they will be having a war with the Ottomans soon, so they need the support of the local population. And when the war with the Ottomans begins, the Orthodox hierarchy supports the Venetians. And in one of the most iconic examples of this war, the Siege of Nicosia, you have Orthodox clergy fighting next to the Latin clergy against the Ottomans. And this tells us something about the long procedure and the long process of cultivating bonds of interaction and unity on the island without, nevertheless, losing one's distinct identity.
Wow, yeah. Whew. From all the way from the 12th to the 16th, we're talking about so many changes happening on the island of Cyprus, as you just detailed explains. And the question that comes to my mind, you mentioned so many times, and I think this conversation has been based a lot about religion. Before we answer the question of what does a Roman or Greek Cyprus identity look like, well, talking about the components of identity, because we have ethnic, sociocultural, but the question that comes to my mind is how important and how big was the religious identity? Because we're talking about, you use religious terms in many ways to explain different peoples, like Orthodox and Latins. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes, I mean, in medieval times, especially in the Eastern Mediterranean, religion was probably the most important symbolic boundary. I also use this concept, which is anthropological. Symbolic boundaries define communities, and they are important for establishing and forging identities and creating this sense of shared communal belonging, which in quite often proves to be an illusion. I mean, not all members of the community share the same sense of symbolic boundaries, but very often the leaders of the community think or hope that people follow this rule of symbolic boundaries. But at the same time, symbolic boundaries are not necessarily divisive, because they also frame and facilitate communication between communities. So they create a framework which help different communities establish a bridge of a channel of communication. For example, by using the same theological language that can help them find a modus vivendi between them. So religion was probably the most important factor of identification in Cyprus during this period. Benjamin Arpel, who is a very well-known scholar of Venetian Cyprus, observes that there is only a limited number of Greek Cypriots acquiring noble status in the 16th century. And the reason for this was that a prerequisite for becoming a noble was to become a member of the Latin Church, to be Latinized doctrinally and ritually. And this is important because it shows that the majority of the population, even if even groups and people who had the economic power to receive noble status, they considered religion important. But at the same time, religion was not always the obstacle for everyday communication, everyday conduct. We have examples of mixed marriages. We have to remember that, especially in this period, the Latins and the Orthodox saw themselves as members of the same church. Okay, they saw themselves as members of the same church, separated by a wall. Okay, and this wall could be breached. Today, unfortunately, Orthodox and Catholics quite often, at least on a popular basis, they see themselves as people belonging in Christians belonging in two different churches. But this was not the case in the medieval period. In Cyprus, Latins and Orthodox lived side by side for centuries, and they could understand the existence of common ground. Same sacraments, same basic doctrinal beliefs, use of icons in the liturgy by both Latins and Orthodox, and so forth.
And there's a lot of social baggage as well that goes into that identity with the passing of the years, I assume as well.
And yes, you also have Latins converting to the Byzantine Rite, learning Greek and being, in a way, Byzantinized or Hellenized, not only religiously but also culturally. You have members of the same family adhering to different rites. There is a case of Stefano Lusignano, who was a 16th century Dominican. He was a member of the Lusignan family when the Venetians ruled Cyprus. And he was a Dominican and a historian, and his brother and sister became Orthodox. His brother became an Orthodox monk, and he took the name Ilarion, and his sister became a nun, Orthodox nun, and she was called Isabella. But he was Dominican, and he was a supporter, a moderate supporter of the Counter-Reformation. So you can find different views, different perceptions, different even different interests within the same family. But this also creates a sense of tolerance and sometimes respect and comprehension, mutual comprehension. So this is why I support this view of Cyprus being both an integrated and a segregated society. And I find that any more monolithic understanding of Cyprus as a battleground or golden age paradise of tolerance is insufficient.
Which is the view that used to be the primary view for many of the medieval fields for many, many years, and I think only recently has been changing. I think with your study, and that brings me into a very nice point now where you talk about this concept of multi-layered or multiple identities as understanding of the sources and society of medieval Cyprus, right? After the Latins, and yeah, there it gets more complicated as you progress. I think that's how I see it.
Yes, we tend to see identity or self-perception as something that is concrete, unchanging, monolithic, but there are so many complexities and paradoxes created by an open reading of the sources, which makes us understand that identities are many. We have multiple identities which are developed in intersections and hierarchies, and these hierarchies can change, and identities are manifested in different contexts, and they depend on particular circumstances. So identities are situational. For example, when an Orthodox Cypriot who is supposed to be obedient to the papacy had to express his or her identity before a Latin bishop or the Latin king in Cyprus, they usually expressed this identity of obedience or loyalty, of being members of the universal Roman Church and the Lusignan Kingdom and so forth. But at the same time, you have these people arguing that when we are in a strictly Orthodox communal context, we curse the Latinists in private, and we believe and follow our own tradition and practices. Καταργίζομεν αυτούς η βία και την πίστην αυτών ου φρονούμεν ως περ αυτή. This is a statement by an Orthodox bishop in the beginning of the 15th century. At the same time, when Orthodox meet Orthodox, Romei of Cyprus meet Romei coming from Constantinople, they try to show that we too are Orthodox, we too are Roman, we too are members of the same genus, how to say, of the same race, of the same broader community. And this is what I mean by using the term situational identities.
I personally love that term, and I've done some research on that, and it's so fascinating looking at the Middle Ages in that light, especially places like Cyprus, for example, that, so again, they're separate from the Roman counterparts in the other parts of the empire, and then with the coming of the Latins, they change again, and they become something different. But I assume that, and you can answer this, the Cypriots, the Cypriot Romans, still saw themselves as part of that larger Roman community, right? And but even when they were changed, they remained the same, or did they start seeing themselves as different if things changed with your practice?
Well, that's a very interesting and at the same time very complex question.
It is.
I cannot give a general answer because we have to look to different cases. For example, you have members. You have Cypriot Romei, like the family of the Apodokathari, who they become part of the elite of the nobility. They are Latinized, and gradually they. They only keep a distant memory of their earlier Romaic Byzantine past. They are very well integrated into the Latin and later Venetian Cypriot nobility. You have Leontios Macheras, who is 15th century Cypriot chronicler. He is an official in the Lusignan administration, and he sees the Lusignans as the only hope the island has to survive, the only realistic hope the island has to survive in this critical moment of attacks from every direction. Mamluks, Ottomans, Genoese, so forth. But at the same time, you see Macheras being very proud for his Byzantine Orthodox identity, and he even complains that the language spoken by the Romaic of Cyprus was barbarized, was in a way alienated from the purely Constantinopolitan language of the Byzantine period. And you also have people who tend to emphasize more their Cypriot identity. At the time Macheras was writing, there was this strong emphasis on Cypriotiki, on Cypriot identity, as well as other Romei of Cyprus who see themselves primarily as Romei. And this is why in the early 15th century we have this plan to approach the Byzantine emperor, Manuel II Palaiologos at the time, and the Ecumenical Patriarchate, and to request concelebration with delegation of clerics coming from Constantinople, so as to show to everyone that the Cypriots of the Orthodox of Cyprus remain Orthodox and in communion with the Imperial Church.
Wow, yeah. So the Cypriot community was literally, and I guess that's what your book kind of underlines. It's just, you know, how complex it was and how many layers of everything, from social to religious, linguistic, and whatever the case might be. A very complex state. At least from what I'm understanding, a state of identity.
I guess this is the same thing happens to other regions under Latin domination, like Crete, the Morea.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Epiros as well. Epiros. Everywhere.
But Cyprus is one of the best studied regions. This is why the book was so rich in. Underlining these complexities.
And a lot of great examples throughout the book, I shall mention. Man, we're running out of time and we're having such a great conversation. A question that I think is important for me to ask is sources. If you can do a quick note on what kind of sources did you use for your research?
Yes, very quickly. I tried to produce a comprehensive examination of this subject, and I used both published and unpublished sources, Cypriot, but also non-Cypriot sources, Byzantine and Latin, works of historiography, Cypriot and Byzantine historians. And when I say Cypriot, I also include non-Greek Cypriot historians, Frankish Cypriot historians, or Venetian Cypriot historians. We have epistolography. We have a rich corpus of letters exchanged between Cypriot scholars and Byzantine scholars in the 14th century, especially for theological issues, the Hesychast controversy. Venetian reports are very important, published and unpublished Venetian reports, because the Venetians recorded literally everything. And Venetian Cyprus is a world of its own. And of course, archaeological material.
Yes, I saw some amazing examples throughout your book.
Epigraphy, icons, frescoes, even architecture. I mean, you have examples of spatial division in churches to accommodate different rites. So all this should be taken into account.
Man, we need another whole 3 hours to discuss that, just the spatial aspect of it. Oh boy, that's fantastic. And I guess that's one of the privileges, I guess, of working with Cyprus, that you have so many sources and from so many different areas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, Cyprus, like Crete, is very rich in all this documentation. Mm-hmm. Archaeological material, yes.
Yeah, so yeah, I really enjoy this multiplicity and richness of the Orthodox Cypriot identities that you define throughout your book. When the Latins came, and then all the way to the 16th century and all of that. And I guess if somebody was to pick up your book and then they had a question about how would you summarize quickly what do we mean when we what does a medieval Roman Cypriot identity entail? How should we see the people from that era?
Well, Cypriots, medieval Cypriots, had, as all medieval people, as we today, had more than one identity. They perceive themselves as people of Cyprus. We also have micro-regional identities and micro-social identities. But generally, they perceive themselves as Romei, which is a term loaded with ideological, political, and religious meaning, because there is a close connection between the concept of Byzantine, Roman, Vasilia, imperial rule, and Ecclesia, church, and faith. The Ecumenical Patriarchate was ecumenical because it was the imperial church. It was the church of the empire. So faith was interwoven with the prestige and status and authority of this ancient empire that continued in medieval times. So it was important for the Orthodox of Cyprus to define themselves or to identify themselves with this once mighty empire. They were defeated, they were humiliated, they lost their property and they lost their pride, but they tried to restore their pride and restore their a more positive view of themselves and their condition by referring to Byzantium, to the Romania, and to themselves as Romae. And to remain Romae, they had to respect and acknowledge the authority of the Byzantine emperor, but at the same time observe the customs and laws and rituals of the Orthodox Church, the Church of Constantinople.
Mm-hmm. And there is another huge section that I wish we had a chance to talk. I wish we had more time about the political affiliation that you worked on about how they were, you know, politically, you know, with the Byzantine Empire in many things.
Yes, I mean the emperor was commemorated in the liturgy in many occasions. So the liturgy was not liturgical worship was not simply a religious praxis. It was also a political performance in support of the Romania, as well as in support of the Lusignan king. But the emperor was the emperor. He was the Vasilevs. He was the most important from the Byzantine perspective. Christian ruler, symbolically, in the whole medieval world.
Yes. Wherever there is Romans, it's Romania. I think it's one of the things the scholars say in many of their books about Byzantium. Wow. So yes, if you're listening to this podcast, pick up a copy of the book, as there's just so much more that we are unable to cover, and it's all so fascinating, and it makes you see Cypriot identities in such a different light. Okay, we're coming to a close, I promise. So what are some of the next steps scholars should take into studying Cypriot identities during this medieval period after what you've done? Like, what are some things that we still need to figure out and discover more?
Well, I would like to say a few things about very quickly about methodology. From my experience of employing different methodologies, I think that scholars, I include myself, we should keep in mind that in medieval societies, especially in cases when we have oppression of some form, the image of a society reflected in the sources is only part of the story. There is always another side, be it tolerance, comprehension, everyday association, or intolerance, persecution, resistance, and violence. And I believe it is rather simplistic to adopt monolithic models of interpretation. Ultimately, as I said before, integration coexisted with segregation. And another piece of advice, we should be self-reflexive. We should be ready to question our own views and establish perceptions. Be open to new sources, but first and foremost, we should be honest to ourselves. And we should not lead our evidence to prove a position, but we should be led by our sources and our evidence.
Very well said and very needed for sure. Well, Christo Vallandi, I really appreciate it. We're taking a lot of your time. And I guess the last question that I ask all of my guests is, what are you up to nowadays? And do you have any interesting projects that you're currently working on or that you're about to work on?
Yes, I am working on a couple of projects as an extension of my work on Latin-ruled Cyprus. The first project is the reception of the history of medieval Cypriot identities by later historiography from the 18th to the early 20th century. Another project is the exploration of symbolic boundaries in Cyprius and the broader Eastern Mediterranean, and how these boundaries operate in multi-religious geographical contexts. And I am also doing some research on this idea of the late Byzantine Mediterranean and the way Byzantine religious culture and physical mobility created and transformed this fragmented Mediterranean world into a more unified cultural space.
Well, best of luck with those. I look forward to reading them.
Thank you.
I hope they're accessible and I can find them. So I look forward for those. And I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed the conversation and you made me like medieval Cyprus even more.
Thank you. Thank you, Evan. Thank you so much. Thank you for
Thank you so much.